Some pastors I know seem to be able to construct a long series of sermons on a specific topic. Some even use more of a Bible study format. That used to be a weekly or a bi-weekly meeting on an evening during the week. I know that sounds puzzling to some in the modern Church of God. Remember those old days? How many of you remember midweek Bible studies? Well, yeah, a few, well, just about everybody, I guess. That goes back quite some days. Now, when they do that, they might even have like a 10-part series on lessons from the book of, you know, whatever, Genesis. I think Mr. Myers was pretty good at that sometimes, too. I guess in a way, with classes at Foundation Institute, that's what's being done with most of them there, I suppose, modern church history included. But it's every day instead of, you know, spread out over a week till the next class. But, you know, I have a confession to make. Confession's good for the soul. I may have one or two others today. We'll see. I've not been all that good at doing that for sermons. Over the years, several times I've given a 3-part series on the Holy Spirit. Now, the Meadvillians all remember that probably. That goes all the way back to the 1980s. For the first time I put it together, it was based on material given at the old ministerial refresher program that we used to have in the Worldwide Church of God, where we'd go into Pasadena and be there for 2 weeks. I think the first round was 3 weeks. After that, it was always two, for a series of classes. Typically, for ministerial pastoral education now, we just have online meetings. It's all conducted virtually. But there have been other times, I think I might have done a 2-sermon series or 2 or 3 on different things. But for the most part, I've not gotten into that so much. But you know, sometimes things just sort of fall together after the fact. That's what seems to have happened the last 3 weeks. 2 weeks ago, on our first Sabbath together here as a new congregation and the first local service after the Feast of Tabernacles, I gave a sermon that had one key point, and it was one word: focus. Focus, focus, focus on our goal, our calling, our life in Christ, as the Apostle Paul might have put it. Last week, with a number of our beloved brethren suffering and a few dying from COVID, as we know, we've heard the announcements and seen them, there was another topic to go through. Infections following the feast from that, I spoke about something that can be a huge distraction and a barrier to our focus, and that's discouragement. We can get discouraged sometimes when trials pile up or when things happen that we don't understand. Mr. Guy alluded to that in his sermonette too. I still recall a funeral message that I heard, and I believe I referenced it last week, by Mr. Tom Clark about 2 years ago at the death of someone related to us by marriage, Nathan Fultz. One of his nieces is our daughter-in-law. But Mr. Clark said, after the death of a 50-year-old man from mysterious heart ailment of some kind with no warning, he said, there are questions for which we have no answers today. There are questions for which we have no answers today. But that doesn't mean we will never have answers. And that's where faith comes in, you know, where Paul admonishes us to walk by faith and not by sight. Does it change anything in the plan of God? No, it doesn't. My wife's mother died at the age of 58 when Janelle was 25, unexpectedly, following surgery for colon cancer, which was successful. 9 days later, she died from a blood clot in her lungs. Questions for which we had no answers that day. My mother died in 1963. She was 43 years old. I was 11. She left my brother, myself, my dad. And there were questions for which we had no answers that day. My dad died in 1992 at the age of 70, which sounds frighteningly close. At the age of 70, from esophageal cancer, even though he had never smoked. There were questions for which we had no answers that day. Of course, 3 years later, in his case, the church that he had known for over 30 years fell apart. It would have broken his heart. I don't know whether that was an answer. I guess we'll find out in the future when I'm able to greet both my parents in the resurrection on one condition. This condition, that I do my part. So sometimes we don't always have all the answers. And sometimes we have to turn to that flip side of discouragement, which is encouragement. Instead of being discouraged, encouraged. And I hope that that was understood as part of the message last week. So here we are today at what could be the third Sabbath in a row. And I haven't told you that I'm giving a three-part series of sermons because I had no idea until I started putting this sermon together this week. And it turns out, lo and behold, it's a three-part series of sermons. So I can do it as long as I don't know what I'm doing. Kind of frustrating. What's been percolating this week? Well, my wife had a handout she was looking over one morning when we were enjoying our morning cup of coffee. It came from David Johnson at Foundation Institute. He had handed a brief 2-page document to all with a series of quotes, mostly from well-known or famous people. There were a couple of unknowns they didn't know to whom it should be attributed, about a particular topic. Now, seeing where I'm going with this, lining it up as a third part, any guesses as to what that topic is? The quotes were all about character. Character. That seems like a general topic that could be part three in an ongoing series of sermons, so let's take a crack at it today. How does it fit? Well, I started thinking about it. It seemed that it just might. After all, keeping a godly focus demands godly character, right? Philippians 2, verse 5. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. That's a familiar verse to every one of us. You have to have the character of Jesus Christ if you're going to stay focused on the goal. At least be building it. And you have to have focus if you're going to develop more of the character of Jesus Christ. Because this world has all kinds of distractions all around us. Jesus Christ's focus was perfect, and so was and is his character. As an answer to discouragement and a guide to encouragement, that seems to me even more straightforward. Mr. Guy went and swiped one of my scriptures today. Dr. Guy, you're in trouble now. But I'm going to use it anyway. It's in Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. He started in verse 3. I'll start in verse 5. You have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. And yes, it does almost have the impact of a question, because then he follows through with what could be an answer. Here is that exhortation. My son, don't despise the chastening of the Eternal or the Lord, nor be discouraged when you're rebuked by him. For whom he loves, he chastens, and he scourges every son whom he receives. That's probably not the way we would describe it in our modern explanations or in modern English. But the concept is of providing guidance, direction, structure, and yes, chastening. Correction is part of it. If you endure that chastening or correction, then God deals with you as with sons. That's increasingly sounding strange and out of place in our culture, isn't it? The idea that parental love could be evidenced by correction? Shocking. But I think all we have to do is look at our culture and look at our society to see where that is true. Nor be discouraged when you're rebuked by him. He's going to come back to that in a minute. Look at that word in verse 5, discouraged. There it is. That's what we talked about last week. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as sons. For what son is there whom a father doesn't chasten? Well, I don't know. We could ask that question in today's culture, because there are tons of sons and daughters that receive scarcely any guidance, correction, chastening, because it's viewed as being abusive. Now, believe me, please understand, abuse is one thing that is intolerable on any level. But a bit of correction need not be understood that way. Saw a statement by a family psychologist the other day that was, I think, well put. He was talking about the propensity for our culture to describe everything that doesn't quite work out perfectly as dysfunctional. He talked about families that struggle sometimes. That doesn't mean they're dysfunctional if they're not perfect. It just means they are struggling and enduring the storms of life. And he had a point. He had a point. It says, if you're without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you're illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we've had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? It talks about how their intentions were just temporary for this life. He's talking about it for eternity, that we can be partakers of his holiness. Now, he goes on to say, look, let's be honest. No chastening seems to be joyful for the present. You know, did you ever thank your parents when they said you're grounded for a month and you said, oh, thanks, Mom, Dad. I really wanted to be stuck in my room for a month. But, of course, grounding and stuck in your room doesn't mean the same thing anymore. You have the internet, you have your computer, you have your cell phone. Now, real punishment would be to take the smartphone away. Who knows? What a world, how it's changed. Therefore, key verse, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. Be healed. Using the struggles and the storms of life and the guidance and the correction that comes to point toward a different goal. It also helps us build the character of Jesus Christ. The word discouraged we just saw was in verse 5. In the context of one of the toughest tests of character ever, staying strong, staying positive, even when having to be corrected or chastened. Again, we heard about trials and tests earlier today. That's part of life in serving God. It just is. But is there any exercise more character testing than that? I don't know that there is. Now, even though the word character never appears in the King James Version of the Bible or the New King James, it's exactly what God is working in your life and mine to perfect our character. Let this mind be in you. That's what it was talking about. What does he expect to see? That's what I want to talk about today in the third part. We talked about focus. We talked about getting discouraged and then being encouraged, not allowing it to weigh us down. Today I want to talk about character. His character, his mind, his values, being his children. I ran across this quote the other day. The struggle to be better takes place during our daily choices. People of exceptional character stand out from the crowd because they develop the wisdom and strength to know and do the right thing in the face of pressures and temptations to do otherwise. Isn't that right? I think it is. It's a man by the name of Dr. Michael Josephson who founded an institute called Character Counts. I think you can see why. Sounds a lot like Hebrews 12 to me. So what does God expect of his children? The things we're going to look at today are not just some nice platitudes. They're building blocks. They're part of it. They're part of that character. Things that would be good if we really could put them into practice in our lives on a permanent basis or on a frequent, most of the time, aimed for goal basis. They're real and they're important. In fact, they are qualities God will insist on seeing in his children who will bear his name for all eternity. And when you look at it, I think they're also the answers to keeping our focus and staying encouraged. Now, I admit, here's another confession. I have a gimmick today. I have several points. I'm not going to tell you how many because that defeats the purpose of prolonging the, let's see, now agony is not the word, involvement, that's the word I want, yes, in the sermon. And that is that all the points begin with the letter C. I'm sure you very quickly picked up on that character, C. Okay, so we'll use this gimmick today to try to help. First one is conscience. Conscience. Another quote from this same institute founder, people of character nurture and honor personal conscience. It's an internal moral compass that helps them maintain their integrity. Three key words there, nurture, honor, and integrity. We need to add, I think, that a guided conscience, a trained conscience, has to be formed by exposure and conformity to the law of God. Otherwise, it's only what we humanly think is right. You know, you've heard the phrase, let your conscience be your guide. Well, that works fine if your conscience is trained by God's law. If your conscience is, get out of my way so I can get there first, it doesn't help too much, does it? But assuming that our consciences, after being in God's church in many cases for years, even decades or more, we'll assume that our consciences are trained by God's law. And there are three words we need to focus on. What does nurture mean in that quote? The word only occurs once in the King James Bible, and it's not even translated the same way in the New King James. It's in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. Ephesians 6 and verse 4, it's translated training in the New King James. You fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. In the Old King James, the word is used is nurture. Find that interesting. Sometimes just using a different translation can give just a little bit of a shade of meaning that we hadn't expected before. To train, in this case, could mean to nurture. The Greek word is paideia, P-A-I-D-E-I-A, P-A-I-D-E-I-A. It means tutorage, that is, education or training. By implication, it can also mean disciplinary correction, chastening, instruction, or nurture. And we're back again to Hebrews 12, too. So we're told in this verse, fathers, don't make your children angry, but guide them by all means in the ways you need to, but that includes educating and training, at times a little course correction, and in nurturing them. Nurturing them. You're trying to help them see and give them what you see they need. Obviously, as they get older, that changes. They begin to come to the place where they must make choices themselves. You don't treat a 16-year-old the same way you treat a 2-year-old, or vice versa. Most of the time, we probably think of this verse in connection with raising children, just like it's used here. But do you see something else here? It's true, it's used as parents, but who's our parent? What is God to us? Isn't he working with us in the same way? Wasn't that the whole point of Hebrews 12? That God is nurturing, at times correcting, and used the word chastening? That is his way of educating and tutoring and training his children. And we have to learn the course instruction to learn to be like he is. All of us as parents, I'm sure, brethren, have tried whenever we've had that challenge before us or when we do to point our children in that direction. But we also acknowledge that they are independently functioning human beings. And they must make choices too. And God will work with all of his children we know at one time or another when the time is best for them and when they are reachable and teachable. And that's what we're looking for. Bring them up. That's what parents do. God's doing the same with us, isn't he? He's bringing us up in the teaching and training and nurturing and caring. How long have we been at this, all of us? I made reference to expecting a very pleasant reunion next spring in Alberta. By then, it will have been 49 years since we first met this one member lady. I gather that neither one of us are going to be in our 20s or 30s anymore, which is about the way it was when we first met her all those years ago. But it'll be good to see her again. And we've been all trained and nurtured and guided for almost 50 years since that point. She was very special to us. She was one of our favorite go-to babysitters when we needed help and with a young family. She just lived a few blocks away at the time. And now it's a few hundred miles, but I think the connection will still be there. Are your consciences, mine and yours, being nurtured in our spiritual growth toward God's family? That's the idea. Second term, honor. What does it call to mind? Well, maybe you'd think according respect or giving it its due or something like that. The statement was giving honor talked about people of character nurture and honor personal conscience. In other words, they don't continually cross the lines and destroy their character by violating their conscience. Then there's the word integrity. Those of you who are mathematicians recognize the connection. Whole numbers are called integers in mathematics, and it's the same root word as integrity. It's like our spiritual wholeness is what we're talking about. It's like a reputation. And that's kind of hard to build back if you destroy it. A couple of quotes I picked up from this handout sheet from Mr. David Johnson. Here's one by Abraham Lincoln. Character is like a tree, reputation like its shadow. The shadow is what we think of it. The tree is the real thing. Interesting. This from a man who had about a year and a half of formal education in his life. Character is like a tree and reputation like its shadow. The shadow is what we think of it. The tree is the real thing. Here's one that's a little bit quirky and amusing from Elbert Hubbard, kind of known as a sage back in the early years of the 20th century, a man that Herbert W. Armstrong met and conversed with on occasion. Mr. Hubbard died on, I want to see, it was either the Titanic or the Lusitania. I forget which one, but I believe it was the Lusitania. I believe he was on board the Lusitania when it was torpedoed by the forces of Germany in World War I. Elbert Hubbard said, "Many a man's reputation would not know his character if they met on the street." You have to think about that one for a while. Many a man's reputation would not know his character if they met on the street. It goes to show, what are we actually all about? It makes us stop and think. So I've got a few of those to throw at you today. They're little head-scratchers. And here's one from Thomas Paine. Probably not one we'd quote on a lot of fronts if you know much about him from history. But he did say this, "Character is much easier kept than recovered." Character is much easier kept than recovered. And that's certainly worth thinking about. You can go a whole lifetime, and we've all seen it probably in some individuals in public life, whether entertainment or sports figures or politicians or whatever, somebody who can go a whole lifetime of service and then destroy it in one foolish move. And how do you get that back again? Easier kept than recovered. Couple more. People are impacted by our example, so we have a responsibility to other people as well. Here's another quote from an unknown source. Character is what you are in the dark. Character is what you are in the dark. Here's one by Baron Thomas Babington Macaulay. He was an early 19th century British historian, educator, and politician. Baron Macaulay said, "The measure of a man's character is what he would do if he knew he would never be found out." The measure of a man's character is what he would do if he knew he would never be found out. That's character. That's not a bad definition, is it? Then here's a quote from Pastor Doug Johnson. I can do this because nobody will ever find out. Nobody will ever know except God and Jesus Christ and the 24 elders and billions of angels. Some of you have heard me speak long enough, have heard that. Oh, here he goes again with the billions of angels thing. It's important to remember, brethren, humanity, the human level is not all there is. Second C for today is compassion. You know what? Sometimes you see some horrific descriptions of crimes, much as you strive to avoid checking up on the news. I ran across one the other day that was so awful I won't even talk about it. And it all comes from a lack of compassion, a lack of empathy, to use another word, a lack of being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes and care about them. Compassion. Here's a quote from this Institute, Character Counts Institute. People of character have compassion, a genuine concern for the well-being of others. Genuinely caring. Does that ring a bell at all? Sounds a lot like a definition we used to hear years ago, an outgoing concern for the good and welfare of others. Remember that one? I think we all do. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. First Corinthians 13. You know a chapter, the love chapter. Though I speak with the tongues of men and angels, but I have not love, I've become sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. Though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, but I have not love, I'm nothing. You could substitute compassion here, I think, in this case. And though I bestow all my goods and to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but if I have not love or genuine care for others, it profits me nothing. Love suffers long and is kind. It doesn't envy. It doesn't parade itself. It's not puffed up. It doesn't behave rudely. It doesn't seek its own. It's not provoked. It thinks no evil or imputes no evil. It doesn't rejoice in iniquity, but it rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. It never fails. That's quite a quality of character. But whether there are prophecies, they will fail. You know, we can think of a handful. What about Jonah's prophecy about Nineveh? It failed. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. We know in part, and we prophesy in part. That's a good thing to remember always for all of us. But when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be done away. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I'll know just as I am known. Now abide faith, hope, love, these three. The greatest is love. What I'm saying is that compassion is an aspect of love. A couple of more quotes for you to think about. Here's one from Abigail Van Buren. Dear Abby, you're familiar with that? The best index to a person's character is A, how he treats people who can't do him any good, and B, how he treats people who can't fight back. You know, those are pretty good points. How you treat somebody who can't do you any good, they can't return the favor, in other words. And how do you treat people who can't fight back, who have to just take it, whatever it is you're dishing out or I'm dishing out? I'm sure many of you have been in situations on jobs where you had to just take it a lot of times from bosses who were being a little less than compassionate. It's not easy, is it? And it teaches us lessons, too, on how we should be and how we want to be. Ralph Waldo Emerson, American essayist, philosopher, poet, wrote, "You cannot do a kindness too soon because you never know how soon it will be too late." That's That's worth thinking about too, isn't it? You cannot do a kindness too soon because you never know how soon it will be too late. How many sad tales have we heard of in human history, maybe seen in our own lives, of things that just didn't get sorted out before it was, as they say, too late? That's difficult. Third C, consideration. People of character are considerate. They think about the way their actions will affect others. And so, of course, what they do is try to avoid hurting and do good instead. That's an important character consideration. Consideration. Sounds pretty solid biblically to me. Look at it this way. And I don't mean that we should always go around trying to puff ourselves up, but how many times in our lives have we managed to avoid difficulties when we practiced this point well? Have you ever had an instance where you were tempted to just give somebody a piece of your mind and then you held back for some reason or another and decided, you know what, I'm going to bite my tongue, as they say. I'm just going to bite my tongue and I'm just going to swallow my hurt or disappointment. I'm just not going to say anything. There's a proverb about that. Remember, it says, a soft answer turns away wrath, but angry words stir up strife. How important is that? Can you think of instances in your life where you heaved a sigh of relief later and said, oh, I am so glad I didn't say what came to my mind? What first leapt into my mind and I almost leapt out of my mouth? Now, I'm sure being human, we've probably also had the other experience, all of us, where we let something fly and then we thought, oh, what have I just said? Why did I say that? I'm sure we've had both experiences. Let me ask you a really hard question. Which one feels better afterwards? That's not a hard question. It's not rocket science. But the chief thing, brethren, we ought to be saying or doing is to evaluate it in light of God's truth and His law and His way of living. David said, put a guide or a guard on my lips. Don't let me say things like that, he asked. It's important. A couple more quotes for you. The three hardest tasks in the world are neither physical feats nor intellectual achievements, but they are moral acts. To return love for hate, to include the excluded, and to say, I was wrong. Sidney J. Harris, British-born American journalist. Born 1917, died 1986. Neither physical feats nor intellectual achievements, but moral acts to return love for hate, to include the excluded, to say I was wrong. Another quote, William J. Bennett, written Book of Virtues, a couple or three of them. If we want our children to possess the traits of character we most admire, we need to teach them what those traits are and why they deserve admiration and allegiance. Children must learn to identify the forms and the content of those character traits. Yes, they must. Yes, they must. They have to be taught. Speak to some of the school teachers among us and find out what their experiences have been, both good and bad, both encouraging and not so good. And I think you'll hear both stories. Go back to Philippians 2 just for a moment. We're very familiar with verse 5, but what about verses 1 to 4? Philippians 2, 1, therefore, if there's any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. That is consideration. And then follows the verse we know so well. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. We know the golden rule, Jesus Christ's teaching from Matthew 24. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. We have to think about that. We know there's a terrific example in the book of Genesis, chapter 39 of the book of Genesis, the example of Joseph. We probably all have our favorite heroes of the Bible. For various reasons, this man is awfully high on my list. Someone I want to meet in the kingdom of God. Genesis 39, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Eternal was with Joseph. He was a successful man. He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. His master saw that God was with him and that the Lord made all he did to prosper, and he found favor. Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. So he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. What would it be like to have someone that trustworthy working for you? And here's the description of it. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had that the Eternal blessed his house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and the field. Thus Potiphar left all that he had in Joseph's hand. He didn't know what he had except for the bread which he ate. But the most difficult, troubling part of the whole story comes in the next few words. Now, Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Now, fellas, don't you be sitting out there thinking, yes, there are so few of us. Maybe true, but, you know, look at the trouble it got him into. And it came to pass after these things that his wife's master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. You know the story. She said, lie with me. But he refused, and he said to his master's wife, look, my master doesn't even know what's with me in the house. He's committed all that he has to my hand. But look at his reasoning. This is why he's such a hero of the Bible. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you're his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against Potiphar? Is that what he said? Sin against God. And so it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, he did not heed her to lie with her or even to be with her. He got out of the house. Now, one day she tricked him and caught him, and you know the consequences. But look at his approach. His consideration was based on his fear of God, but his reasoning to her was, I can't do this to your husband. He's treated me honorably as an honorable man. He hasn't even treated me like a slave, to all intents and purposes, but as a trusted and valued employee. I can't do that. It would be sinful if I did. But to her, the point was, he refused to treat her husband like that. Quite a story. Fourth C is confidence. Confidence. You might think, well, God's servants have to be sort of weak. No, they don't. Meek and weak are not the same thing. Weak means absence of strength. God doesn't want children who are weak. He wants children who are teachable. That's a difference. Fourth statement, people of character are confident that they're good enough, valuable enough, and strong enough to withstand potential consequences of principled conduct, including the loss of money, jobs, or friends. What will you and I stand up for? What will we be willing to pay if that's what it costs to be obedient? Well, here's a quote for you from a man by the name of Sam Ewing. Hard work spotlights the character of people. Some turn up their sleeves, some turn up their noses, and some don't turn up at all. That's probably right, too. Some turn up their sleeves, some turn up their noses, and some don't turn up at all. You know, Joseph's example in Genesis speaks to this too, doesn't it? You look at the next few verses in Genesis 39, and you know what happened. He was willing to pay the price of conducting himself in a righteous manner, even though he was lied about. And I would suggest that even though his life was in danger, because she made a false accusation, basically she accused him of sexual assault or attempting to assault her. Look at verse 15. Verse 14, she called the men of the house and spoke to them. He brought in a Hebrew to mock us. Now she's complaining about her husband and his poor judgment. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. So it happened when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out, he left his garment with me and fled and went outside. She didn't say she ripped it off him, trying to give him a little encouragement in what she wanted. She told the same story to her husband. He was angry. I understand that. But interestingly enough, he didn't have him executed, did he? He put him in the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the prison. Do you know how long this went on? Years. We're going to guess that Joseph was something like 17 when his brothers sold him into slavery, 17, 18. How old was he when he finally stood before Pharaoh? 30. How old was he when he thought he might be released after the dream of the baker and the dream of the butler? He was 28. Two more years went by, even after it seemed God was intervening. Isn't that interesting and good for us to learn? I'm sure he could have used Tom Clark's funeral sermon back then when he was age 28. There are questions for which we have no answers today. Why did God give me the ability, he might have thought, to foretell the dreams of the baker and the butler, and they came out exactly right, and one of them was pardoned and could speak up for me if he wanted to? Nothing happened for two long years. He might have thought he was going to die in that prison. It wouldn't have been an unlikely outcome. He lost a favored position because he refused to compromise with the law of God. And he was, to use these terms, confident enough, as this quote was, to withstand potential consequences of principled conduct. It meant he had to go to jail for who knows how long. Now, we know the rest of the story, but we know it from the vantage point of hundreds and hundreds of years. Joseph didn't know it when it happened as it unfolded. And sometimes, brethren, we don't know it as things unfold in our lives either. We're looking at it from this side of things. Now, when we're all spirit beings in God's family, and we're talking about this, you know, 400,000 or 500,000 years from now, we'll look back and say, why were we so worried? But it's a little different vantage point from 500,000 years away, you know, light years or any other kind of years. So when we have our next church potluck as we're spirit beings, let's talk about it some more. Because I think potlucks are a good thing for spirit beings to do, don't you? As long as somebody brings some apple pie a la mode, you know, even though we probably won't need it then. Thomas Holdcroft, writer, theology professor, life is a grindstone. Whether it grinds us down or polishes us up depends on us. Life is a grindstone. Whether it grinds us down or polishes us up depends on us. Fifth C, courage. People of character are courageous. To uphold their honor, they confront difficult situations, they face risks. They do the right thing, even when it costs them more than they want to pay. That's very closely related to the last point, but it involves courage. And there's one special episode that shows the courage aspect, not fear of losing favor or money or position, but immediate loss of life, and it's in Daniel chapter 3. It's still an amazing story. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or as their Hebrew names were, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Why is it we remember Daniel's Hebrew name, but the other ones Babylonian names? Daniel had a Babylonian name too. It was Belteshazzar. Somehow. Anyway. You know the story. You know how it devolves, this image they were all supposed to worship when they heard the sound of the orchestra. Now, I don't know. Maybe the music was so bad they just couldn't bring themselves to bow down. I'm sure it was a lot more basic than that. And, of course, his advisors immediately pointed out the failings of these three men because they were out to get them. And they charge and accuse them in verse 12. Nebuchadnezzar reacts in rage and fury, and he asks them in verse 14, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, that you don't serve my gods or worship the gold image which I've set up," which I'm sure looked like him. "If you're ready at the time, strike up the band," that kind of thing. And then his question, "Who's the God who will deliver you from my hands?" Well, you know what? In the very next chapter, Nebuchadnezzar wrote a part of the book of Daniel and defined who that God was after his 7 years of madness. You can look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's marvelous, amazing answer, verse 17. "Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you." We don't have to think about this. "If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king." Basically, what they said is, "You can only kill us once." That's pretty brave, wouldn't you agree? You can only kill us once. We only have one life. It's reputed that Nathan Hale, one of the first deaths in the American Revolution, aged 22 in a botched spying attempt around the city of New York, was captured by the British almost immediately, didn't even accomplish anything. And his words, were told, "I regret that I only have one life," or "that I have but one life to give for my country." Wouldn't we say the same about God? "I regret that I only have but one life to dedicate to my God." Basically, that's what Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah said. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know the rest of the story. The king was singing a different tune by the end of the chapter. 29, "I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego will be cut in pieces." He really didn't get the point, did he? It's like he had to speak up and say, I'm on this God's side. I mean, I'm going to attack anybody who attacks him," when he was just ready to murder three of his servants. But he says why. "Their houses will be made an ash heap because there's no other God who can deliver like this." We know what he meant, because he had said, "Who's the God who will deliver you from my hands?" That's what he was thinking. So the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Now, you may have had trouble on your job, but I don't think you had to go through this to get a promotion anytime recently, did you? To avoid the burning fiery furnace and then get promoted? Now, that's called stress on the job. Men of courage. You know that phrase, "more than they want to pay"? That's all here, isn't it? It doesn't come any harder than this. One very brief quote, an English proverb attributed to an unknown source: "A smooth sea never made a skilled mariner." A smooth sea never made a skilled mariner. You have to fight the storms of life to develop the strength that you need. And God knows that. Last C. Well, actually, there are seven. I'll give you seven. How's that? You get seven for the price of six today. Number six, control. People of character control their emotions, their physical appetites, any urges that might induce them to compromise ethical principles or sacrifice long-term goals for short-term indulgences. That is so not like our society now. Think about the advertising you see these days. You see, here's an ad for a new car. You can lease this new car. It'll only cost you X number of dollars per month and X number of dollars at signing. Read the fine print. How much will you pay by the time it's done? If that's fine, if that's what you're planning to do, if it matches your needs, we've leased a car once for my wife for 3 years, and then we ended up buying it off the lease, but didn't make sense for most of us in the ministry because we drive too much. Most lease programs have limits on your mileage. But read the fine print. But our world is geared to immediate gratification. Immediate gratification. We have fast food. We have drive-through. We have Uber. We have, you know, all kinds of immediate gratification types of things on just about every topic you can think of. God's plan is not about that. His plan is about in it for the long haul, in it for the duration. Brethren, we know there is a battle for the control of our minds. Galatians 2 is not unusual or untested territory for any of you. Galatians 2, verse 1 says, he says, after 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem with Barnabas, and I took Titus with me. I went up by revelation. I communicated to them that gospel which I preach among the Gentiles privately, lest by any means I might run or had run in vain. And verse 4 says, this occurred because of false brethren. False brethren. We understand some of those difficulties. Look at they secretly brought in, came to stealth to spy out our liberty, etc., etc. You could go to other references. Paul's probably more direct is actually the same numbering. Ephesians 2 verses 1 to 3 talks about he made alive once you once walked according to the course of this world, the prince of the power of the air. How much control do you and I have over the challenges we face? Galatians chapter 5 has a list, for example, of avoiding fleshly appetites. Starts in verse 16, walk in the Spirit, you'll not fulfill the lust of the flesh. The flesh lusts against the Spirit against the flesh. Do we understand that? Do we make sure we're looking at the right lists for our lives, for the development of our character? Turn to 1 John chapter 2. First John 2, a lot of good stuff in this chapter. Verse 15, John, think of John's position in life. He was probably in his late 80s or early 90s by this point. Sometimes people look at that and they think, well, sweet John, all he talks about is love, love, love. Well, look at it more closely than that. He's giving you the distillation of 60 years of conversion. In verse 15, he says, don't love the world, that is the system, or the things in the world. He's not talking about the people. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. All that's in the world, and he categorizes it three mannerisms, three basic files, I guess you'd say. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, that's not of the Father. That comes from our culture. But that world is passing away, and its lust, he who does the will of God abides forever. I mentioned last week in the sermon that, ironically, the things we can see and touch and feel, those are the things that are temporary. The things we can't see and fully understand and grasp now, those are the things that are permanent. We haven't seen a vision of God's throne room like a very few of his servants did, like Stephen did, like John did, like others. We haven't seen that. But we do have this same powerful incentive that John leaves us. What is going to last and what won't? You ever had the disconcerting experience of going back to maybe a childhood haunt, a home, a school, and finding it had all been torn down and was gone? You ever had that happen? It's as if somebody reached out and took away part of your life. Several years ago, we were in Branson, Missouri, for the feast. And I grew up in Missouri, and I spent the years from the age of 5 until about 11 in Springfield, which is just north of Branson. That's where my mother was from. That's where we came in the church. That's where she died and was buried. Then I started school in Springfield. And during the feast, we were going to go up to Springfield one day with our daughter Debbie and her husband Guy, and I guess William would have just been a baby then, about a year and a half. Eleanor was nowhere to be found yet. And I said, I want to show you my old school. We had just been there the year before with our granddaughter Laura on a family trip and walked into the old school, and the principal or whoever was there said, well, go ahead, show her your old classrooms and stuff. So we were traipsing through the school, and my wife and I and Laura, and we were having a big old time. And we went back about a year and a half later. We drove to the site, and there was nothing there. Just the foundation. The building was gone. The driveway, the circular driveway leading up to the front of the school where the buses came in, it was all there. The place where I got off the bus my first day of first grade, and I was so convinced that I was right. Everybody went that way down the hall for the first graders, and I, no, it's this way. I went that way and walked into the eighth grade classroom. I was rather stubborn, but I sure felt silly. Later on, teacher was very kind. There were a few snickers from the eighth graders, I guess. But it was gone. And Debbie, our daughter, looked at me, and she was so sympathetic. She said, oh, Dad, she said, you should see the look on your face. It was gone. My childhood was gone. In some ways. You know what? We need to stick with the things that will last. That will last. A couple of quotes for you. Abraham Lincoln. Nearly all men can stand adversity. But if you want to test a man's character, give him power. Does that ring a bell in our world at all? Nearly all men can stand adversity. Well, I'm not so sure that's true as it might have been in the 1850s or 60s, but if you really want to test a man's character, give him power. Sad but true. Here's one from Helen Keller. You know the story of Helen Keller, I'm sure all of us do. Character cannot be developed in ease and quiet. Only through experience of trial and suffering can the soul be strengthened, vision cleared, ambition inspired, success achieved. Spoken by Helen Keller. Cannot be developed in ease and quiet. She had a point, didn't she? She had a point. Here's one from Horace Greeley, famous American journalist. He's the one who famously said, "Go west, young man." He also said this, "Fame is a vapor, popularity an accident, riches take wing, only character endures." Fame is a vapor, popularity an accident, riches take wing, only character endures. I don't think he could possibly have realized how true that statement was. Last C for the day for character, competence. Competence. Character requires competence, the ability to devise options and implement good decisions. Brethren, we are first and foremost children of God. We are first and foremost disciples of Jesus Christ. My question is, how good are we at it? How good are we at it? This is our calling. This is our profession. How good are we at it? You know, we know the Proverbs that say there is a way that seems right to a man, Proverbs 14:12 and 16:25. That's our starting point, to know that only God's way has the needed options. If our human ideas conflict with His law, guess who's wrong? Guess who's wrong? So we have to work things out another way. Another proverb, Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs 3 and verse 5, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Eternal. Depart from evil. It will be health to your flesh and strength to your bones. Honor him with your possessions, the first fruits of all your increase. Your barns will be filled with plenty. Your vats will overflow with new wine. Well, probably not as many of us have barns and vats these days, but I think we get the point and the principle. Don't just let life happen. Even the ancient Israelites were told to choose life. Remember Deuteronomy 30:19? Choose. Choose wisely. We know God's promises are there. How many times have you read 1 Corinthians 10, maybe when you were discouraged or you were down, and you read that verse in verse 13 when it says that he will not allow us to be tempted beyond what we're able? 1 Corinthians 10:13. But you know, being human, I think sometimes we also have to ask, well, what if I messed up? Now, we've all done that. I know that because it says so in Romans. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. What if I fall on hopefully rare occasions? Well, then what do? We had a memorial service this past Sunday in Avon Lake near Cleveland for Linda Henderson. She died August the 6th after more than 20 years with autoimmune difficulties and problems, and finally, when she contracted COVID, her body just couldn't fight it off. But I asked for comments and reflections and memories from the family, and every one of the ones submitted by her children, everyone stressed what they learned from her. She was very heavily involved in competition, riding, English-style dressage competitions. There were some beautiful photos and clips in the slideshow of her jumping obstacles with her horses back in the years when she could do that. And they all talked about the fact that she taught them a lesson using the horse. They say it was literally, if you fall off, assuming you are not significantly injured, one of the sons said, you get back up on that horse and you finish the round. No matter how embarrassed you are or how angry you are or how upset you are, you get back up on that horse and you finish the round. Those are lessons. That's a legacy to pass on to her children. There was a very amusing story from her husband about how they met. It was a blind date. He was enrolled in the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, and Linda's brother was one of his classmates, and there was going to be a parents' weekend coming where family members would be there, and Linda's brother asked if Hal, they had not yet met, would be willing to escort his little sister to some of these events. And he told Hal that his sister was really nice and kind of cute, he said. So Hal said, well, he'd be willing to do that, but he wanted a photo first. He wanted a picture first. This was, as it said, 1966, so he wrote a letter and to his sister, and she said, well, okay, but she wanted to see a picture, too, of him. So as the way Hal relates the story, so he said, President Ronald Reagan may have been the first politician to use the term, but the phrase trust but verify had a beginning much earlier than that. So he said apparently they both passed the photo contest because they were married for 51 years until her death. So choosing, get back up on the horse. Brethren, we have to do that too, don't we, spiritually? Sometimes we have to deal, like David, with the fallout of our bad decisions. But we get back up on the horse. Proverbs 24:16 talks about a righteous man falls, but he gets up again. He gets up again. Please don't say get up one more time than you fell, because that's mathematically impossible. But if you get up every time you fall, that is possible, and that's what we should do. That is what we should do. A righteous man may fall seven times and rise again, Proverbs 24:16 says. The wicked will fall by calamity. Implication, they don't get up. They don't get up. A couple of other thoughts that match biblical principles. George Eliot, actually the pen name for Mary Ann Evans, British novelist, it's never too late to be what you might have been. Think about that. It's never too late to be what you might have been. If we're talking character, that's true, isn't it? Abraham Lincoln, my great concern is not whether you have failed, but whether you are content with your failure. My great concern is not whether you have failed, but whether you are content with your failure. Brethren, this is a huge subject. I know that, you know that. We've been through some deep and challenging and sometimes sobering topics these past 3 weeks in these messages. Focus, find courage, have his character. And it didn't start out to be a three-part sermon, but lo and behold, it ended up there. God reminds us of the need of all those things in his word. He promises eternal life to his children who become like him, who grow like he wants us to, who seek his paths, who build his character, who really begin to look just like their dad. Because that image is the very character of God. There's nothing more important in this world. That world will go its own way as it always has. You and I have a different direction to go in our lives. Focus, courage, character. And now comes the time for the sneaky confession. If this sermon sounds vaguely familiar to those who've been part of the Meadville congregation, it may be because I gave something very similar to it about 8 or 9 months ago in Meadville. But I couldn't tell you that at the beginning. Then you wouldn't have heard the new wrinkles and the updated quotes and all the stuff that our beloved family from Youngstown hadn't been exposed to yet. But I promise I won't do this too often, because if you look out and see the Meadville contingent sitting back there going, oh no, here he goes again. I've heard this one before. Well, I've done that a few times in my ministry, but like I said, confession is good for the soul. Sometimes, though, I do it because I'm not sure if the audience got it the first time around. Have a wonderful Sabbath. I'm sure they did get it. But I'm also sure that it seemed to fit as part 3 of the sermon.